Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Krista Detour. Krista is a singer-songwriter out of Bloomington, Indiana, who currently has 5 albums out and a new one coming up shortly. She has toured all over the United States as well as Europe. Krista defies genre, but the quality of her writing has been compared to the likes of Leonard Cohen, Laura Nyro, Tom Waits, and Joni Mitchell, company she is more than happy to keep. Krista, how do you feel about being compared to that rather illustrious list of songwriters?
Well, it's very humbling, but it's also gratifying to think that there are people and critics out there that appreciate what I do and consider it at that level. So I think it makes me work that much harder.
And how did you start writing songs? And when did you start?
Well, the first song I wrote when I was 14, and it was called Never What I Seem, which I have a recording of it someplace, fraught with adolescent angst and the search for identity. And I played piano. I started playing piano when I was 7. And so it was, and writing poetry, bad poetry when I was 9-ish. And it was a natural transition for me because I had begun singing. And I don't remember when it occurred to me that I would begin writing, but I just did. And then one thing just led into another.
Were you classically trained in piano or?
Yeah, I wasn't in my early childhood. I had a piano teacher who came to the house once a week, and I never ever practiced. But her coming seemed to be enough to get me going. And then I started singing and wanted to be able to buy sheet music to sing to, pop songs and things I heard on the radio. And that improved my reading really drastically. And then I ended up getting a degree in classical piano performance when I was in college. So,
and what were some of those first pop songs that you bought?
Well, I was a huge Beatles fan. Uh-huh. Huge Beatles fan. So, you know, everything that Paul McCartney ever wrote. Since he was, you know, he's the more lyrical writer of the two. I know everyone's always googly about John Lennon, but Paul McCartney was kind of my guy. Peter Gabriel, mm-hmm. and Genesis, just a huge, huge influence on my writing and stuff that I was playing when I was a kid. So,
did you think back when you began to write songs and then when you actually studied classical piano, were you aiming towards performing in the genre that you're performing now, which is sort of across genres, I guess?
Yeah, I think I was. I remember I was cast as the lead in the school musical when I was 13 or 14.
And which musical?
Oh, I went to a Lutheran school, so it was something about Esther and Ahasuerus. I was Esther. As a matter of fact, the only two musical leads I realize now that I've played have been fairly religious or holy figures. I played Esther and I played Maria in The Sound of Music.
That may explain a lot.
It actually did influence my writing, but I was at the cast party for Sound of Music, voted least likely to be a nun. So I think that all worked out. I looked up, I think, when I was about 14, and I decided that I would be hugely famous. I'd be a hugely famous singing star. And I bet people in my class that I'd be famous and that I would, you know, be on stage with all these various gigantic people.
Where did you grow up, Krista?
I grew up in Torrance, which is in Southern California. And I left as soon as I was done with high school and really pretty much never went back to L.A. Lived all over the country and Southeast Asia. And I would just never was specifically geared for big city life, I don't think.
So let's trace that. Okay, you left L.A. Obviously, you didn't go.
Right. The tracing goes, I went to Northern California and finished college, California State. And after college, to Southeast Asia, and I taught piano and English and was the musical director on the Yongsan Army Base. So
is that in Korea?
Korea, yeah. Uh-huh. I directed Man of La Mancha and South Pacific. And
with folks from the military performing?
Yeah, so yeah, seriously. Yeah, colonels and Marines and all kinds of folks. And that was actually great fun. And after Southeast Asia, I moved to Louisiana for a while. traveled back to California, then to Oregon. There was a brief stopover in Georgia. Landed in the Florida Keys, and then finally settled in Bloomington, which is my mother's hometown.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. How long have you been in Bloomington now?
Since 2000, I think, is when I got into town. So the longest I've ever lived anywhere.
At the point when you came to Bloomington, were you already starting to have quite a repertoire of your own music that you were beginning to perform? Or what point were you at in your career then?
What I had was a body of work that I had always been working on. But what I hadn't been doing is really pursuing it on the national circuit at all. What I was doing was other things and sort of avoiding it. I had dealt with a lot of stage fright for a lot of years, and I don't know where it came from or why it set in, but it did. But I continued to write, and I did, you know, I played in bands. I played in bands in Louisiana and in Florida, and when I was in college, I would play out some, but it was always a fairly painful experience. I was one of those people who almost wanted to lose my lunch before I got on stage. It was really sort of, it was just something I didn't want to pursue much. And I decided I would be a Phoebe Snow or somebody who was just, you know, Steely Dan, somebody very comfortable in the studio and just not so much a stage person.
Mm-hmm.
I got to Bloomington and I just decided what I would do is put down a CD, just get a lot of the songs out of my head because I was traveling with all these songs that were basically written down nowhere. And I walked into Airtime Studio in a very roundabout way, and David Weber, who's the owner mm-hmm. of Airtime, heard me play a couple of songs with a group that I was with and said, "Who are you and where did you come from?" And it started a chain of events that led me to where I am. So,
and how did you lose or overcome your stage fright, or do you continue to perform with it, but you just deal with it?
There are times when I have to grapple with nerves, but at this point now, it's only in the very, very big settings. When I'm doing, in Europe, when I'm doing live radio, and I know that the listenership, you know, their equivalent of All Things Considered, I've done before, in Holland and in Germany, where the listenership I know is in the millions, and it's a live performance. That's something that I have to work myself through psychologically and put and set aside. But beyond that, the nerves aren't so much with me anymore. And part of it has to do with having been on the road for a little while now. I'm entering my third year on the road. And I did this one-woman show called Slightly Deranged shortly after I got here. My friend Rich Perez was the music artistic director, and he still is at Bloomington Playwrights Project.
Right,
talked me into doing this cabaret.
I remember this. I remember seeing you.
Oh wow, wow! And I actually did it. And the process of having to remember all of the dialogue, which was much of it was improvised, but I still had points I had to hit, and it was still within a framework, the improvisation. And the lighting cues and everything else that had to happen, me just performing my own songs was nothing. That was nothing compared to what I had to do theatrically, which I had never done before. And it occurred to me at the end of the show that I didn't even worry slightly about forgetting where I was in my own pieces. I had this whole different part of my brain that I had to engage.
Uh-huh.
And I got to the end of it and I thought, wow, this isn't even an issue anymore. And that is really, it was as simple as that. I don't know, maybe somebody should teach a class in stage fright and say, all right, you're going to sing, but you're going to have to juggle at the same time and stand on stage and do both of those things. And I guarantee you singing on stage will be easy.
And you had that musical theater background someplace behind you.
I did actually have that much behind me. And so everything sort of came together and in the right place and the right time and the exact right circumstances. And it's inexplicable to me how it happened, but doing Slightly Deranged then influenced all of my stage shows after that, because mm-hmm. I do end up being a storyteller in my shows, even wherever it is that I'm doing them. I tend to set the scene. I tend to improvise as much as I can around telling stories about my life and the songs and things like that. And I did bring that theatrical element through to taking it on the road. So,
you're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Krista Detour. Krista, over the last, I guess, 7 years or so that you've been beginning to tour, perform more, and right, putting down lots of CDs, how has your style shifted over this time period?
Well, the album that got me signed with the record label that I'm with and that got the attention of a lot of the area songwriters, including Carrie Newcomer, was Mud Show. Mm-hmm. And Mud Show is definitely influenced by the Midwest and the landscape, the people, the place. I think Bloomington, Indiana is a unique place in the world, and I've lived many places, and every place has its own flavor and its own culture. There's something here that's quite amazing, and I think it's the combination of the university and the incredibly high level of musical and artistic output that reverberates around this place. And the people that are drawn here because of it, combined with, there's a certain humility in the Midwest. There's a certain lack of pretension that is so refreshing, especially coming from living in LA, where pretension is the name of the game. People are much more genuine and much more open to possibility, much less cynical, much less demanding to be shocked rather than having an open mind about something mm-hmm. entertaining. So I think those elements combined have influenced my style in that I pay more attention to the people around me, the details around me, and the landscape around me than I did when I was much younger and writing Dream in a Cornfield, where everything was, I call it the mating call of the North American 20-something. So it's shifted. It's shifted with time, and it's shifted with influence, and it's shifted with, you know, having spent some time in Europe now, which is a whole different perspective. Having done, you know, put together two sort of one-woman shows. I just did one recently. And they're really cabaret shows. I mean, I really have to be honest about that. They're not so much the one-woman show platform, but...
And when you say a cabaret style, that includes a little more banter
audience? It's a little more banter with the audience. It's a through line. There is definitely improvisation, but the storyline runs from start to finish, and you're taking them from point A to point C and trying to wrap up ends from start to finish.
You mentioned Mud Show as, yeah. And that's the first album I became familiar with of yours as well. I think you performed over at the Buskirk Chumley Theater soon after it opened.
I think I released it at the Waldron.
Yeah.
In the auditorium.
Curiously, I asked my daughter, because she really likes your stuff, and I asked her, do you have a question for Krista that I could ask? And she said, well, ask her how she comes to write in persona.
Right.
Because so many of her songs, you mentioned telling a story through the cabaret show,
right,
so many of her songs are in persona, and that's pretty unusual for a songwriter.
Wow, what a great question. Well, the way I write is, it's a very visual thing for me, and I stand in the place. If it's on a bus, I am sitting on the bus, and I am looking around, and I am seeing everything that's around me and the people that are around me. And I tend to write in persona from other people's perspectives more often, I think, because if I am writing in a separate persona, I think the piece has a more universal element to it. I'm not just writing about my own angst or perceptions or philosophies. I'm trying to write from a more human place, a thing that we all relate to. I do it because it is a more interesting place for me to write from. Because I have the theatrical background, because I'm an avid reader, and I see things in such a literary perspective that sometimes there's just an array of characters, of people that I could choose from, and who I would give voice to.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm a closet playwright. You know, I've never written one, but I would love to. I could see myself doing it at some point. down the road and, you know, only showing it to three of my closest friends.
Let's take a listen then to 100 Years More, which is coming up, as you said, an album not to be released until 2010. Tell me a little bit about how you came to write that song.
I was sitting in the studio and I have been, it's been a very, very long dry spell for me. And if you're a writer, that can tend to be distressing because you think, oh God, I've written everything that I have to write. I've written everything there is to say for me. And every once in a while, I'll just walk into the piano and hope that something happens. And this was one of those times. I was working on another piece that I was hating its direction, really struggling with it. And something else just sort of whispered in my ear and it started and it was done and written probably in about a half an hour. And it poured out onto the paper and I said, wow, this is very interesting.
There are things I do that I never did with 100 years more. And my worry's gone, and my worry's gone in a great big boat with a steamer trunk sail the world. There are books I'd write that I've thought aloud with 100 years more. And a fountain pen, and a fountain pen, and my worry's gone, all my worry's gone. Write them down. Try not to think on it, where time is moving on. 'Cause when the cows come home, it'll still be gone. It'll still be gone.
Krista Detour. This song reminds me just a little bit of some of the songs that I heard on Wilderness Plot, which was another sort of a group project that you worked on with a number of local songwriters based on the work of Scott Russell Saunders. Could you talk a little bit about what that experience was like to write with other people based on someone else's work?
That was actually the first time ever that I had written a song inspired directly by someone else's work. I definitely take inspiration from a lot of poets and a lot of authors. But to take a piece directly and then write a song that can translate directly, it was a brand new thing for me. And it was an idea that Tim Grimm brought to a songwriting group that I'm in with Carrie Newcomer and Michael White and Tom Rosnowski. And he brought this little book, and it was vignettes, very short stories. They're only a page and a half, 2 pages maybe. And he said, let's all pick a story out of this book. Here's the book. We'll all write a song and meet you here in a month because we only meet once a month. We're all, at least three of us are touring. Four of us are actually touring, and it's just very hard to meet more than once a month. And we came back, and all the songs were good. And so he said, let's do it again. So we did it again. And there was very little overlap in the stories we picked, and that, I think, is a testament to how different we all are as writers and our perspectives. And the second set were even better. And so he said, let's all do it again. And the third set that we came back with were, you know, they were all of them very solid songs. So he got Scott Saunders involved, asked his permission, and we just started this stage show idea. And it all developed very organically. All of us brought in different ideas and different perspectives. And, you know, someone said, hey, how about a montage to start it? And how about this sort of musical soundtrack in the background? And so it became a CD. It became a stage show where the author travels with us. We've toured it. WTIU did a special on it. APT, PBS National, has picked it up. It's been quite amazing. What there wasn't was writing collaboration. We wrote everything individually. Mm-hmm. Where the collaboration comes in is how we all sang on each other's pieces, even on the track, played on each other's pieces a bit. And the collaboration came in that way. Backup singing, musical accompaniment, things like that. So it was really wonderful. Yeah, great experience. And it's still going on.
Yeah. When you write now, do you write almost always on your own, non-collaboratively, in terms of your own music? Or do you ever collaborate with with David Weber or with other folks in terms of writing?
David and I collaborate some. We collaborate some. On my last album, we've got a couple of collaborations. It's great to have someone like him there because he is his own musical powerhouse. And to walk in, you know, we're married, and I can walk in and say, okay, I need a riff. I've got this line, but nothing that I'm working out on the piano is working, and I've fiddled on the guitar a bit, and nothing's coming, and he can write, he can say, how about this, and throw a riff at me or something, which is great. He's also a very talented producer, so he produces everything we do. I ordinarily don't collaborate a whole lot, but in some cases I do. My favorite type of collaboration is if somebody hands me music that's already written and done, and I fill in a lyrical line, or somebody hands me a lyric sheet and says, can you put this to music? I've collaborated with Jim Krause. He's a friend of mine here, and he's with the university, and he's a very, very talented guy, photographer and filmmaker. And he writes these beautiful, beautiful Celtic influence melodies. And he handed me a couple of these things, and I put lyrics down to them. And that's been really, really interesting. I'm starting collaboration with Malcolm Dauglish, who's also a local guy whose style is completely different than mine. Mm-hmm. Hammer dulcimer, Appalachian, Celtic influence, gorgeous stuff.
And vocal choirs.
In that way, Wilderness Plots and even Malcolm have influenced me. I have arranged three pieces for written, you know, a choral piece for women that I've done, and then arranged the Hampton Sisters, which is a song off Mucho, for a choir in Oregon that they commissioned me to do. So lots of perspectives have broadened. Malcolm is in the songwriting group that I'm in now, so he's the newest member. Yeah, it's been terrific, and now I'm heading into the UK into a truly collaborative event called the Darwin Songhouse, where I was one of two American writers asked to go to the 16th century farmhouse in Shrewsbury, England.
Wow.
Along with six other UK writers, to write collaboratively songs that celebrate the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth in his hometown, and see what we come up with, and then perform them at a concert at a theater that was built specifically for this event. I'm really looking forward to it. I have no idea what's going to happen with seven other songwriters and seven other styles and egos. I have no idea, but how exciting.
Have you met each other before or
never
talked at all?
I haven't. Some of these folks may have. The ones in the UK may have, but I haven't even met. Mark O'Reilly is the other American songwriter, and he's on the tour, a very award-winning guy. I have not ever met him.
How long will you be together in the 16th century?
1 week we have.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we'll go back in August, and we'll play the Shrewsbury Folk Festival, and we'll each have our own slot in the Folk Festival, but then we'll also, there'll be a section where we do these collaborative songs again, so they better be good.
It's a very, very interesting and exciting way to look at creating music.
Yeah, I think so, and unusual for me, and I would bet you probably unusual for a lot of them. A lot of songwriters are very independent, very lone wolf kind of people, believe it or not. Kind of shy, a lot of us. I shouldn't say I'm shy. I'm really not shy, but a lot of them are. Very, like, on the stage and then gone, you know, just very, very introverted folks. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
What's your process like when you start to put together a song, or you start thinking, okay, it's time for me to get a group of songs together? Because your albums seem to be sort of theme-focused, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, Mud Show, the album was finished in 7 days. It was start to finish. I had no intention of writing an album. It didn't happen that way. It was just the floodgates opened and there it was, and there was the album. And got me a lot of attention and changed my life, that album did. Changed everything about the musical world for me. So the process then of writing Cover Their Eyes, which was the follow-up album to Mud Show. In a way, I was looking for that to happen again. I mean, everyone wants that to happen. When the floodgates open up and you actually get a song out, and I think most songwriters, really, I think all of us sort of believe we're really just piping in something from someplace else. It feels that way. It feels very, it's part of us, and we channel it, but not to sound often too often New Agey land, but
A lot of writers talk about, though, about actually, you know, almost catching the drift of a voice and putting them through.
When you get something good, it actually does feel like you reached out and grabbed something from the out of the air, and that was passing by you. Michael White said, I wonder if the Beatles knew that they were mining all of the great pop songs that were out there. You know, I wonder if they knew that they were taking them from everyone else. And there was this idea that there's this big holy field of music and some people find it first, you know, and we can, none of us can take very much personal credit for it. I wanted that to happen again with Cover Their Eyes, and it didn't. It was a much slower process of putting together these songs. You know, and then I was also thinking of things like the market that I had opened up, things that would appeal to the market. And those things, that kind of thinking, I think does nothing but get in the way of writing. So I really struggled with that one because so much of my head and my sense of the business and my sense of the record company pressuring me for something that was more radio worthy, you know, which is their business. They're trying to sell records. And I get a good bit of radio play in Europe. And it's sort of like, regardless of the fact that what I write is not specifically for the radio. And the record companies, you know, always wanting that. They always want to be able to push it more that way in Europe. It's less important here. I got in the way of the process a whole bunch. And so I decided with the album that I'm doing now that would not be the issue.
Does the new album have a title?
It doesn't. The working title is Conversations, but it's really just a working title because a lot of it was based on conversations that I've had with people in my life or conversations that I've overheard. And so it's gone through a number of incarnations in my mind, but as it proceeds to write itself, I don't know what it'll be called. I don't know where I am with it yet. I've got a year before it's released and 6 months before it's manufactured. So there's lots of time. I'm bringing in a world-class hurdy-gurdy player who played here at Lotus named Gilles Charbonnet. Mm-hmm. And he is quite amazing. And I'm thinking of the orchestration, and this one will appeal strictly to my tastes. And
so you're still writing songs for the album, or do you have all the songs written?
Now.
You're right in the middle of it.
Right in the middle of it.
And some songs are complete, the ones that we've been able to hear today.
And there are more than that are complete, but these are the three that seem like a little trio to me. So,
well, let's go ahead and listen to All to Do with the Moon.
Okay.
You want to talk a little bit about that song?
It is actually about trying to explain away all of the goofy feelings that this person is feeling, this person in love, and saying it has nothing to do with you at all. It's shifting apogees. It's the synchronous orbit of the moon. Surely it's the tidal pulls on my sinews. It has nothing to do with you. So that's where the impetus for the song came from.
Truly, sweetheart, my head hangs like the willow. It's all to do with the moon. I've studied the lunar eclipses. I tell you, they're coming on too soon. It's all to do with shifting apogees and the things out there that no one sees. All the light threads woven over and through, but nothing at all to do with you.
All to Do with the Moon by Krista Detour. Support for Profiles comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922. Offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones, Smithville Telephone. Local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Krista, the album that came out before, you had an album of winter songs that came out recently. Can you talk a little bit about that compilation, which is a little bit different for you?
Well, it was written shamelessly. I mean, absolutely shamelessly. We were in Europe. We were finishing up a very long tour. And when we go to Europe, we do okay. But compared to the money that we make touring in the States, because so much of what we do when we're in Europe is press and promotion, so much of it is interview and radio time, it is an expensive endeavor. And so, I mean, everyone sort of knows this, you know, unless you're going to Europe and you're playing thousands of seats, it's not hugely financially lucrative to tour there. And so when we're there for a month...
Are you doing clubs mostly? Or
yeah, clubs or the big openers, you know, the big openers at the Paradiso and places like that, but definitely clubs. But clubs and small theaters is really more like it. It's more listening space. It's not bar shows. It's singer-songwriter venues or small theaters, like I said. So shamelessly, we were trying to figure out a way to make a lot of money before Christmas because we had David as a commercial recording studio. At the time, when we left, the studio shut down. That doesn't happen anymore because he's got an assistant engineer in there that's in there all the time now. But literally business shut down for us every time we went to Europe, mm-hmm. and we did not make nearly as much money as we make otherwise. Just, you know, paying mortgage and expenses and things like that. And we weren't touring at the level that we're touring in the U.S. now. And so, you know, we're at a different touring level. And so money is, as long as the economy holds, money's doing well right now. We're doing very well right now. I have a new agent, and he's doing very well for me. And we were in Newcastle, and I said, let's write a Christmas album. Let's write a Christmas album. We've started doing these holiday shows. We had done one the year before. We were doing a holiday show with Arbutus Cunningham, who's a storyteller, and Art Heckman, who's one of the unsung great songwriters walking the planet. And Carrie Newcomer was on board for it, so I said, let's just do an album. And we wrote it. And it was shameless and to be strictly commercial, but some of it turned out so well, and I was so surprised by it. And it's gotten great reviews. It was, you know, it was in the top 10 albums that was, you know, on the folk DJs lists, and ended up getting really great reviews when I finally released it nationally. 3 months later, I had some pressure from people to get it out there. So it's unlike what I would ordinarily write. And you know, it's like anything else. It's almost like writing a period piece. You're writing a specific thing within specific confines. And so you've got to be as creative as you can. And some of it was written just creatively, you know. I just tend to approach things that way. And then some of it was, I was trying to write in a traditional vein. And it was all a big experiment. And I'm still shocked that I actually put it out nationally sometimes.
Is it The Silver Wood?
The Silver Wood, yeah, and it sells really well, so people really like it.
And did you write all the music on that and then yeah. perform with other folks?
Yeah, I wrote all of it, and Dave and I collaborated a little bit on some of it. He'd toss me a line every once in a while. He'd say something hysterical that would make its way into a song. And then when we actually put it down, we did bring in some other folks to play some parts here and there on it, just a little bit.
So another process, another way of putting something out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you've talked a little bit about touring, how different it is in Europe from touring in the U.S., and that it has a whole different feel to it from what you've said. Can you talk a little bit more about what touring in general feels like to you and how it's affected the rhythm of your life?
Wow. Well, last year I was only booking myself unless the record company booked me in Europe. So when the record company takes me to Europe, they get maximum capacity. And so it's, you know, it's an interview and a show just about every day, or 3 interviews in a day, or you know, 2 press interviews, and then I play the record stores when I go there. In the case of the on-air, like the big radio interviews, very often they'll talk as we're talking, and then they'll translate in German or Flemish or wherever I am, in Dutch. But my performances are always in English. My German is just wretched. Just the accent is wretched. It's so difficult for me. I don't know why. It's one of the, you know, I speak a little bit of French. I speak a little bit of Spanish, and even Dutch feels natural to me. But German I have a hard time with. David Weber, My German husband has absolutely no problem with it at all. It feels very natural to him. Anyway, I tour there, and I am working every day. Occasionally I'll have a day where I can go into Amsterdam and go see something or something. But it is really, really packed. When I'm here in the States, when I was booking myself, I tended to book myself in a fairly easygoing way. I'd go out on the weekends, and I would come back. And I would take some longer tours out. I would go out with Carrie, newcomer still, you know, and which is really great fun. But I was booking myself in a fairly comfortable way for me, because the record company a couple times a year in Europe is really, really grueling. Well, now I have an agent who thinks like the record company does. So I am booked a lot, and I'm gone a lot now. It feels like a thing that started out as a little crystal of an idea that turned into a big snowball and is rolling now. And the balance of life, I think, is an ongoing process. But it is what I'm really working on right now, is creating a balance. Because, you know, Carrie's talked about, you know, waking up in a hotel room and just not knowing where you are. And talking to an audience and really having to remember, okay, yesterday I was in Denver, that means today I'm in Salt Lake. That kind of was more surreal reality mm-hmm. sets in. And getting grounded within it is not an easy task at all. So there is grounding with a connection with the audience, and I think that's what keeps a lot of people doing it. Because otherwise, literally, you're just being hurtled through space all the time in a car, and you know, and then you jazz hands and da-da-da-da-da-da, sign some CDs and get in a car again. And so it's trippy.
And how do you balance, you talked about balance, how do you balance that with the time and space that you need in order to create music, which is a very different atmosphere that seems to be needed?
I've got 3 weeks off right now, and so most of that time is dedicated to nothing but that process. And when I know that I will not be on the road for 3 weeks, I do take a deeper breath. And there is a certain adrenaline that I think drives you when you're on the road. And you've got, you know, there are deadlines all over the place. You have to have sound check and load in times and then radio interview times and all of that kind of stuff. I take a deeper breath, and I have my own studio space that I write in at my house that's separate from the house. And I do tend to go down and away from email as much as I can and from phone calls as much as I can, and try to create a more wide open space, more air to work in. It doesn't always, being on the road sometimes can be an impetus for writing and for brand new ideas. And I can write sometimes when I'm on the road, but in this particular instance, the kind of focus that I need to actually complete this album requires quiet and very little human interaction.
You've spoken about some of the people that you've worked with within Indiana that have influenced you, and you mentioned also the Beatles as being some of your favorite. Are there other singer-songwriters or artists that have been major influences on you? And you can include in that poets. I know you mentioned, you know, that you're a reader of poetry and
right.
fiction as well.
People talk about influences. In our age, we have got to be, anyone who is writing now has got to be influenced by, songwriters especially, we're influenced by every writer that has come before us, because we are inundated with them constantly. From Hoagy Carmichael to, you know, Coldplay, we're influenced all the time. Specifically, the people that I really have connected with have been the people that have both the poetic and artistic turn of phrase and melody, and have the whole thing together. And that would be, you know, Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell, writers like that, Tom Waits. My influences are also, you know, Kurt Weill, Sondheim, Brahms, Mahler, Beethoven, the big Sturm und Drang, you know, German composers influenced me. All that passion and unrequited love, Youssef Komunyakaa is somebody who's currently influencing my work fairly heavily.
Poet,
an amazing poet. Many poets, though. Elizabeth Alexander, Bob Kaufman, some of the contemporaries. In the past, Yeats and T.S. Eliot and Dylan Thomas. That list is endless. What I read influences me. I'm reading A Thousand Splendid Suns right now. Everything is illuminated. What a great book. When I was writing yesterday, I was writing a piece called So Goes the Night that was influenced solely by a panel of pieces of folk art that I picked up at a museum. And that perspective, the folk art perspective, the raw inspiration of folk art, I find compelling in many ways. Film also influences me. Everything influences me. The weather, too much caffeine, everything. Wine.
Do you usually start with lyrics or a melody, or does it shift for you?
Lyrics are almost always first. On occasion, there will be a melody that's ringing that I'll try to put words to. But if the words don't find that melody pretty quickly, the melody doesn't stick around for me too long. So lyrics almost always happen first, and sometimes the entire piece prior to the influence of melody or the chordal structure. A couple of critics, more than a couple, have said that I have like novelist's sensibilities or playwright sensibilities. So I think the words almost always come first because of that. And then the melodies fit in later.
Once you're done with this album, which I know you're going to be working on for a while, what do you see as your... Do you see something coming up next that excites you?
Wow. Well, I am contemplating and working on... always working on polishing the stage show. And for the last holiday tour I did, I took Arbutus Cunningham with me out on the road all through, you know, Chicago. We did Chicago, Minneapolis, Madison, the Great Plains states, you know, Kansas City and Omaha. And I'm working on polishing the stage show and also incorporating some more theatrical elements into it, and maybe some multimedia into it that I find more satisfying and more appealing than being just the shoegazer, you know, somebody thinking deep thoughts and playing them, you know, and something that can separate me a little bit from the pack. There are a lot of singer-songwriters now. Everyone and their dog can write a song and make a CD now. Everyone. And I like to be a little more individual than that. So I'm working on those things, those stage elements. And that's exciting.
And Krista, if I remember, if people want to be able to get more information about upcoming events, you also play a lot of benefits, I know, as well, and give back a lot to the community. It's www.kristadetor. Do you want to spell it out?
Yeah, KRISTADETOR.com.
Yep.
I'm on MySpace, too, and YouTube, and all over.
All over the place.
Yeah.
So you can always keep track of what's coming up next. One other quick question before we go to one other last song. You must be barraged with playing benefits. How do you make decisions about which ones you can take on and which ones you can't?
Well, it's all about timing. I'm doing a big benefit in Washington, D.C. for... It's sort of a Doctors Without Borders group, but people who go into other countries and people who go into Jamaica and Haiti... And doctors, it's a group of doctors. I'm doing an East Coast tour. I'm going to be there. It's going to be to an audience that hasn't seen me before and are coming out to support the benefit. So in some instances, it's just a no-brainer. It's perfect timing and it makes good business sense. And then also, I make a lot of decisions on the benefit front based on my feeling that there is so much helplessness that we feel in terms of what we can actually do to improve to improve some dire situations for people. In many, many African countries and many, many, many countries, the bureaucratic nightmare of getting the money and goods to the people that need it makes it utterly impossible, and I think only increases the despair that people feel. I tend to go with benefit situations where I know for a fact that the money goes directly to where they say it's going, and the cause is local. Here in Bloomington, I know for sure that what is happening is right here. It's Harmony School, or it's
food bank.
The
I know
food
that
bank.
You've done,
that's right. So
Bloomington Playwrights Project,
the Playwrights Project, things that are right here and right local, and I think that keeps me feeling like I'm actually doing something besides the very, very selfish pursuit of my career. It requires me to have most of my attention on me a good portion of the time, and it makes me out of myself and feeling like I am really actually doing something in a time where a lot needs to be done. So I can't do all of them. And especially in Bloomington, I can't do all of them because we're in a small town. If I'm playing here every week, the audience burns out and then they're gone, you know, and then they're off to the next thing. And I think all of the touring songwriters in Bloomington, in every small town in the world, I talk to them on the road. Everyone says, oh yeah, I play my hometown once a year, maybe twice a year. And those things have to be kept in perspective too, because you want your audience to be, for it to be a fresh experience when they see you, and you want to give them something new, and you want to be able to do that when you perform for them. So,
Krista, thanks so much for being on Profiles. We're
sure.
It's been a pleasure to have you here.
It's been a pleasure.
We're going to listen to Teeter Totter on a Star.
Thanks for letting me play these. It's just all demos and. Just, I wanted to do something that wasn't just playing CDs that you've already heard, so thanks so much.
Well, I work all day, no one pays my way, not a penny handed to me. Little sparrow says, that's the way it is. Nothing much is ever for free. But the dreamy time, in the evening time, the twinkle twinkle isn't so
The program you have just heard was recorded in February of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Support comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.